House Education Committee is called to order. This afternoon, we have a very informative informational hearing. I've heard good things about the presentation by Richard, was it Bjelland?
Bjelland, very good.
Thank you. And we're going to hear about changing demographics in Oregon. I know Representative March will not be with us, so he is excused today. And I'm happy to say we'll be collecting fines, at least $2 worth today. Oh, and Representative Shields, I'm sure, is going to deposit his $1. Thank you very much. And Mr. Bjelland, would you like to begin? Thank you very much. And for the record, please give us your name.
Yes, my name is Richard Bjelland. I'm with Oregon Housing and Community Services. And I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to present some of the research that I've done on the changing demographics in Oregon and on the implications, I think, on the educational system. Bob Repine, I would have liked to come here, as he said, to tee me off with you, but he had another commitment, and so he asked me to sort of give you just a short background on why someone from the Oregon Housing Community Service Department is talking to the Education Committee. The reason I've become, I guess, somewhat very knowledgeable about demographics and the changing nature in Oregon is that in my role as the state housing analyst and research person for Oregon Housing and Community Services, I was asked to look at developing a methodology for defining housing needs that DLCD and LCDs could use, that cities responding to the periodic review process could use in defining their urban growth boundaries, since Planning Goal 10 is the housing goal, and when a community has to go through and define their urban growth boundaries, the critical component of that is determining how much housing is needed, and of course what type of housing is needed. And so I set out to develop a methodology for defining that housing needs, and I came to the conclusion that what had been done in the past wasn't very relevant. It was based on the production, and I felt that housing should be based on the population. And of course, when you talk about population, you talk about demographics. If you're doing projections into the future, you have to have an understanding of the changing demographics that are taking place. And I built a model to use demographics as the basis for defining housing needs. I also sit on the executive steering committee for the Oregon Population Survey, and of course that is the Oregon Pop Survey is done every 2 years to develop information about Oregon's population and its characteristics and attitudes to fill in when we don't have the decennial census information. And that also gave me an exposure into demographics. I also got involved in developing a model of predicting poverty in Oregon, and of course that is based on demographics. So there have been a number of avenues that I've taken that sort of led me to do an analysis of demographics. And as I got into it more and more, I began to see certain trends that are taking place there, and I felt that this had implications far beyond just housing, poverty, and other issues. And so as I began to develop some information on it, I started being asked to present that information. And a year ago, I was asked to present to the State Board of Education. I was asked to present to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. A couple of weeks ago, I presented to the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce. And in fact, it's going far afield. On Friday, I'm presenting to the American Fisheries Society because they're trying to get an understanding of their population and how they need to serve that population. When we talk about changing demographics, of course, one of the first things you want to try and determine is, are demographic changes taking place? And when you talk about demographic changes, there are different criteria that you can look at. I mean, are there changes in racial and ethnicity composition, changes in age and sex distribution, and changes in household composition? And all of those have a bearing on the population and an understanding of the forces that are affecting changes in our population. What I'm showing today here is a subset of my total demographic presentation. And it's available on our website, and that's at down at the www.ohcsoregon.gov demographics. And so anyone who's interested in seeing the full extent of the analysis can visit the website there and see the other parts. But I just pulled out certain aspects that I thought would be of primary interest to you all today. I think when you were talking about demographics and the changes in demographics, one of the key elements of that change is the change in the race and ethnicity composition of our population. And any time you talk about race and ethnicity, I think it's important to define the terms that are going to be used. And this has been a confusing factor in much of the demographic studies that have been done in the past, because they have mixed up race and ethnicity when they're really two separate components. And they've often even asked in one question and combined race and ethnicity when they need to be asked separately. And so for purposes of properly defining is that a person of Hispanic or Latino ethnicity may be of any race. And in looking at what I consider to be minorities for purposes of the presentation and analysis here, a minority is defined as an individual of any race other than white only, a multiracial individual, or a person of Hispanic or Latino ethnicity. By process of elimination, then, therefore, a non-minority, or what I'll call a white-only, is a white-only non-Hispanic or Latino person. Now, if we're looking at, I think it's important that Oregon doesn't operate in a vacuum. It's, of course, part of the United States, and so factors that are occurring in the United States and in different regions of the United States help determine what's going to be occurring in Oregon. And so I'll start off by looking at some broad demographic characteristics that are taking place in the United States. And, of course, if we look at the information from the census, we can see that Hispanics, as a percent of race, of those people who identified themselves as white in the census 2000, 8% of them also identified themselves as Hispanic. Of the black population, just under 2%, and down. We come to some other race, and because of this inability in times in the past, and even people of Hispanic origins sometimes have difficulty determining how they characterize themselves as what race they belong to. And so quite often when they filled out questionnaires, they will write in Mexican, Puerto Rican, some other non-racial characteristic, but it's how they perceive themselves. And so when the census gathers that information, it pulls them into some other race category. And therefore, you can see that of those people who identified themselves as some other race, 97% of them also were Hispanic. If you look at the changes that have taken place in the United States since the 80s, you can see that Hispanics in 1980 were 6.4% of the population. They increased to 9% in 1990 and 12.5% in the year 2000, whereas the white population went from 80% to 69%. And when people talk about changes in demographics, you can talk about actual numbers, you can talk about percentages, which has a little bit more meaningful, but if you're looking about the changes that are taking place, it's more important enough to drill down and not just talk about percentages, but the percent changes that are taking place and the percent of the changes taking place. It gives you a much more meaningful picture of determining the dynamics that are taking place that are changing the demographics. So you can see that in 1990, Hispanics represented 9% of the population, yet they represented almost 40% of the total growth in the United States population during that 10-year decade. So if people just look at 9%, they say, well, that's still a small percentage. But if you look at the percent change that's taking place, you can see that the magnitude is significantly higher, almost 40%. Whereas the white population, which was 75% of the U.S. population in 1990, contributed less than 20% of the population growth during that 10-year time frame. Now, if we look at the projected source of U.S. growth over the next 50 years, you can see that 90% of the U.S. population growth is projected to be minorities. Only 10% of the U.S. population growth is going to be that white-only population. Almost 50% of the U.S. population growth is Hispanic. And in fact, if you get out to the year 2040, in that decade, the U.S. will be losing white population. In fact, in the 90s, 12 states lost white population. 100% of their population growth was minorities. Now, that's what's happening in the United States. And in fact, here in the 80s, 16 states lost white population, although four lost total population. If we want to take a look at what's happening by region, you can see that in every region, the percent of the population that are minorities are increasing fairly dramatically, with the West being having the most dramatic increase. And in fact, if you extend this trend on out, by 2010, 50% of the population in the Western United States will be minorities. In the census 2000, we already had three states in which whites were a minority of the population: Hawaii, California, New Mexico, and today probably Texas is in that same situation. 10 years from now, a number of other states will be in that situation. Oregon, of course, exists in the Western United States. So what's happening around us is going to be driving the population changes that are occurring here. If we look at the percent Hispanic of the regional population, again, we can see this similar trend, but it's even more dramatic in the western part of the United States. And in fact, according by the projections here, by 2010, one in three persons in the western United States will be Hispanic. Now, we, of course, are very much impacted by California. And I thought it would be interesting to see what's happening in California. And you can see that in the 90s, Hispanics represented 80% of California's population growth. In fact, California lost white population during the 90s. They had less white population in the year 2000 than they did in 1990. So 100% of California's population growth was minorities during the 90s. Now, if you look at, sometimes it's interesting to look at just the actual numbers itself. And you can see that in the 1990s, the 10-year increase in California's Hispanic population growth was just under 3.3 million. That is equivalent to the entire population of the state of Oregon. That's how much California's Hispanic population increased over a 10-year time frame in the entire population of the state of Oregon. Now, if we look at Oregon's minority population, we can see that in 1980 it was 6.7%. That grew to 9.2%. In the year 2000, it was 16.5%. But if you remember, looking at 1990, minorities only represented 9% of Oregon's population, yet they represented 52% of Oregon's population growth during that 10-year time frame. So again, if you just look at percentages, they can be very misleading. You have to look at the percent changes that are taking place and the percent of those changes in order to understand the dynamics that are going to be driving our future population. If you look at Oregon's population by ethnicity, in 1980, Hispanics were 2.5% of Oregon's population. 1990, 4%. In 2000, 8%. Again, 8%, small number. Look at Salem's population. Went from 3.5% to 6.1% to just under 15%. You look at Marion County's population by ethnicity. Went from 4.7 to 8 to 17.1%. Over the last two decades. Now, I happen to live in Woodburn, and I'm on Woodburn City Council. Woodburn, I think, is somewhat of a forerunner that's going to be happening in many other communities in Oregon. In 1980, Hispanic population was 18% in Woodburn, about what Marion County's population of Hispanics were today. In 1990, it was 31.4%. And by the year 2000, it was over 50% of Woodburn's population. So you can see the dramatic, rapid changes that can take place in a population. I thought then it would be interesting to look at the impact on the educational system. And so I asked the Woodburn School District to give me a breakdown of their student population. And in 1990, in which, if you remember from the previous slide, Hispanics were 30% of Woodburn's population, they represented 44% of the student population in the schools. In the year 2000, which they were now 50% of Whitburn's population. They represented 64% of the population in the school district. 4 years later, they were now up to 72% of the population in the school system. So in a 14-year time frame, they've gone from 44% of the student population to almost 72% of the student population. So I thought it'd be interesting to look at Oregon's public school minority enrollment. And here you can see that looking at the major classifications of minorities, which is by race and ethnicity, you can see while every racial category, which are the first three categories, black, Asian, other Pacific Islander, and American Indian and Alaskan Natives, they have had some growth in population. But you look at the Hispanic growth in the Oregon public school system's enrollment, and you can see a very dramatic increase. Now that's looking at the minority enrollment. So I thought it'd be interesting to look at the Oregon public school white enrollment. And this I thought was very interesting, in that the number of white students in the Oregon public school system has increased until basically 1996-97. And since then, we've had a declining number of white students in Oregon's public school system. In fact, in the 7 years since then, the white enrollment has declined by about 10% in Oregon's public school system. And again, while the minority percent of the increase is changing. And I think that in thinking about it, and you begin to look at the No Child Left Behind measures that are taking place of our operation in our school system, and talking with the superintendent of the Woodburn School System, which has been facing this, and dealing with standardized measures which look at school improvement, and I'll be getting into some slides later on which I think will illustrate the fact that you can begin to raise each individual category of accomplishment within a school system, but that if the mix of the students within the school system are changing, you can have a overall school showing a declining performance rate. And I think that these are factors which are not being adequately addressed when you begin to do standardized measurements of school performance. And so I thought it'd be interesting to see what's been happening in California. And so I said, let's take a longer look at California's demographics. In 1970, 4 in 5 Californians were white. In 2000, whites were in the minority. If you look at California's public school system, only 1 in 3 children in California's public school system is white. 45% are Latino. This is in the entire state of California. And in fact, you look at California as the largest state, over a 30-year time frame, the minority population increased from 20% to over 50% in a 30-year time frame in the largest state in the United States. So this can demonstrate the dramatic changes that can occur. In Los Angeles, only 10% of Los Angeles student population is white. 70% are Latino. In fact, in District F in the Los Angeles Unified School District has 60,000 students. 98% are minorities. Contains Belmont High School with 5,500 students with a 40% graduation rate. And I'll begin to talk about some of the implications of this later on. I was asked to present to Mount Hood Community College in their long-range planning department, so I pulled out some statistics on their area. And again, Gresham went from 1.6% to 12% of Hispanics in a very short time frame. And you looked at the percent of population increase and comparing Multnomah and Gresham, and you look at the white only in Multnomah County during the 90s, only 2% of Multnomah County's population increase was white. 98% were minorities. In the city of Gresham, 13%. Again, minorities and Hispanics, tremendous population growth in the city of Gresham. You look at the percent of the population increase, and again, you can see that 10% of the white population increase in Multnomah, 90% minorities. Now, if we look at the growth rate of Oregon's population, in the 80s, the non-Hispanic population only grew by 6.3%. The Hispanic population grew by 71%. In the 90s, the non-Hispanic grew by 15%. The Hispanic grew by 144%. Again, Salem's population, 203% was the minority growth. Marion County's population growth, 90s, 167%. Now, if you look at population growth comes from two components. Basically, your net migration, which is the number of people moving into your state, less the number of people moving out of your state, and your natural increase, which is your births less your deaths. And you can see over the last five decades that the natural increase has been somewhat fairly constant. Migration patterns have changed significantly. In fact, in the 80s, when Oregon was going through some tough economic times, we basically had almost as many people leaving the state of Oregon as moving into it. Of course, in the 90s, that pattern has changed, and I think you'll continue to see that pattern increase because of the fact that if you look at the composition of the pattern, the migration patterns, that will explain a lot of what's taken place. Now, I think one of the important things when you're looking at population is, and from an educational standpoint, is the percent of the population that is foreign-born. And if you look at it by race and Hispanic origin, down at the bottom of this chart, you can see that of the white lone population, only 3.5% were foreign-born. Of the Hispanic population, 40% of it is foreign-born. Of the Asian population, about 69% of it is foreign-born. And again, that some other race alone, which is basically the Hispanic population that's not identified by race, similar to the Hispanic characteristics. How do immigrants come into the United States? There are basically six states that immigrants come into, California, Texas, Florida, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois. From there, they disperse, and of course, Oregon is in the path of that dispersal of immigrants coming into the United States. Now, if we want to look at the percent distribution of Oregon's foreign-born by region, you can see that almost half of the foreign-born in Oregon is from Latin America. About 1 in 4 are from Asia, Europe being a smaller component. And you look at the percent change in the foreign-born population in the 90s down at the bottom of the slide, you can see that that's doubled, 108%. So the amount of foreign-born in Oregon is changing very rapidly as well. And basically, foreign-born represents 8.5% of Oregon's population. I think another characteristic is looking at the legal status of the foreign-born population. And that you can see of the foreign-born population in 2000, about 30% were legal aliens. About the same proportion were naturalized citizens, had become U.S. citizens. About 1 in 4 were undocumented aliens. The rest were temporary residents and refugee arrivals. So this gives you an idea of the composition of the foreign-born population. If you look at the citizen status of the foreign-born population, in the United States, about 40% have become naturalized. In Oregon, it's about 1 in 3, 33%. And of course, it's very much a function of how long they have been here. With those who come before 1970, almost 82% are now U.S. citizens, and of course decreasing, and those who came in the last decade, only about 1 in 8 become U.S. citizens. The other component of population increase is the natural increase. And so I thought it would be interesting to look at what happens, because people said, well, you know, if we don't have any more migration patterns, is that going to change what's happening? And in 1981, of the births in Oregon, Hispanics represented only 2.7%. In 1991, they were 7.7%. In the year 2001, it was 17.4% of the births. Now, if you may remember, in 2000, Hispanics represented 8% of the population, and that 8% of the population contributed 17% of the births. Yet when you add in the other side of this coin of natural increase of the deaths, Hispanics represented only 1.4% of the deaths. And so that even though they represented 8% of Oregon's population, they represented just under 50% of the natural increase in Oregon's population because of the difference in births and deaths, because the non-Hispanic population is an older population. And so even if you had absolutely no migration patterns coming in, you would still have this phenomenon of significant increases in our population from a very small segment of the population because of this difference in natural increase. And I'll get into showing why this is taking place. Of course, one of the reasons is that Hispanics have a higher birth rate, about double that of the white population. Now, in looking at what's happening at the county level, from 2000 to 2003, 9 of Oregon's counties lost population during that time frame. And it's a combination of regions. Either they had negative natural increase, they had more deaths than they had births, or they had more people moving out of those counties than moving into it. Of course, this has an impact on the educational system as well. You look at, there are 10 other counties that are at risk because they either have negative natural increase, again, more deaths than births occurring in those counties, or there are people leaving those counties, more people leaving those counties than are moving into it. So that's over half of Oregon's counties that are at risk of significant population changes and decreases in population changes. Now, when you're looking at demographics, it's one thing to look at the total number of population, but it's another thing to look at the households. And when you look at the number of households, of course, an important element of that is the average household size. And you look at a non-Hispanic household, and there's about 2.5 persons per household. Look at a Hispanic household, it's about 4.3 households. And so that even though in 2000 they were 8% of the population, they represented less than 5% of the households. And as a population, and historically it's been proven that as a new population becomes integrated into an area, they may begin to take on some of the characteristics of that population. So if the average persons per household begins to change in the, let's say, the Hispanic population, you could have absolutely no growth in the population, but you could have a significant increase in the number of households being formed. And of course, from Oregon housing standpoint, I mean, we were more interested in the number of housing units needed to be prepared, so this is an important element. Now, I thought it'd be interesting to look at the source of Oregon's population growth since the census 2000. And in the first 3 years, you can see on the screen on the left here, of Oregon's population growth, 42% of it was white from 2000 to 2003. And even though they represented 43.5% of Oregon's population, where on the far right, the Hispanics, in the first 3 years, they represent 37% of the population growth, even though they were 8% of the population. But in the last year, Hispanic total growth in population in Oregon has now exceeded the growth of the white population in Oregon, even though, again, they were a very small percentage of the population. So these are the future changes that are going to be driving the contribution of the Oregon's population. Again, you can look at it from Salem's population growth. 46% of Salem's population growth in the 90s was Hispanic. Marion County's 54% of Marion County's population growth in the 90s was Hispanic. Yet, if you look at what's happening in Marion County, in the 3 years since the census, 81% of Marion County's population growth in the last 3 years has been Hispanic. The white population of Marion County has been only 11% in the last 3 years. So almost 90% of Marion County's population growth is minorities. What's the impact on the school system and everything else? Because these are the new entrants into the system. In fact, you look at the population change by ranked by the counties that had the significant amounts. Look at even Washington County here, and you can see that 36.5% of Washington County's population growth in those three-year time periods was Hispanic, more so than Washington County's white population growth. And in fact, Multnomah County lost white population during those 3 years. 100% of Multnomah County's population growth was minorities during the 3 years. And looking at Oregon's counties, for the last two decades, 100% of seven of Oregon's population growth in those seven counties have been minorities. You look at those other counties, a significant portion, and this is one-third of Oregon's counties. You look at the middle third, and still even down at the bottom of the middle third, basically one-quarter of the population growth are Hispanic or Latino. I'll shift gears a little bit here, and let's talk about age and sex distributions of the population, because this begins to explain some of the factors that are taking place here. I think we're pretty much aware that Oregon, that the population is basically an aging population, and that the 65 and older is an increasing segment of our population. In fact, if you look at the five population segments, the only population segment that has remained basically constant is the 25 to 44, representing about 30% of the population. The under 15 and the 15 to 24 have been decreasing in size. But again, that's the total population, and that's sometimes misleading. Of course, we know that we're becoming older, as you can see by the median age, other than the war years. But what really gets interesting is when you look at the age and sex distribution of the population. And you can see that back in the 1900s, we had this classic pyramid shape in which the youngest age segment of the population was the largest age segment, and in each succeeding year, it became a smaller segment of the population. By the middle of the last decade of the century, it was beginning to take on less of a pyramid shape and more of a barrel shape. In fact, by the year 2000, it was definitely taking on a barrel shape. But again, that's the total population. And if you disaggregate that and look at the white population, it becomes even more dramatic. And you can see that of the white population, it's becoming more loaded at the top end. And in fact, if you look at the childbearing years, you can see of the white population, the smallest age segment of the white population is in the childbearing years. And in fact, if you look at the under five white population, it's now smaller than any age category until you get up into the almost 60s and over population group. And yet it's that under five, which is the coming into the school system, the future family generation characteristics. You look at the Hispanic population and you get a completely different pattern, in which the childbearing years is one of the largest segments, and in fact the under five is the largest segment of that population. And again, that's the population that, again, is going to be impacting the educational system. Again, you look at the non-Hispanic, and again, we see that pattern as the under five is a smaller segment. You look at age and sex by nativity as to whether they were born here or foreign-born, and you look at the prime working age of these different populations, and you can see that the foreign-born population, 59% of that population is in the prime working age, compared to only 42% of the native-born, whether they're minority or non-minority. And I'll begin to show some of the implications of this as well. If you look at the share of the Hispanic population by whether they're first, second, or third generations, you can see that in the year 2000, 40% of the Hispanic population was first generation. They were not born in the United States. 28% were second generation. They may have been born, but their parents were not born in the United States. And this trend stays fairly constant until you begin out the 2020, yet still that first generation is a significant component of the Hispanic population. Important element, of course, is the educational attainment by Hispanics who are at age 25 to 64 by generation. And we can see that of the first generation, 54% have less than a high school education. Another 24% have a high school education. And so even through the second and third generations, over half of them have either less than a high school education or a high school education. Now, what are some of the implications here in the educational system, and not only the educational system, but on the workforce and everything else? You look at the population that is limited English proficient. You can see that the native-born population, 99% are English proficient. Only 1% is limited English proficient. But if you look at the foreign-born population, 44% of them are limited English proficient. In fact, if you look at the most recent immigrant entrants, 60% of them are limited English proficient. So, looking at the percent of Oregon students meeting the reading standards in 2004, taken from the Oregon Report Card, and looking at the racial and ethnic comparabilities, we can see that when you look at the Hispanic population, it is way down on the scale of those who are meeting the reading standards. And so this is a significant issue that needs to be addressed. This is reading standards. If you look at math standards, that same situation occurs. And what are some of the implications of this, of course, is that when you talk about math skills and reading skills, that's an important component of the workforce. And if we look at, I thought it'd be interesting to look at what's happening in our workforce. And over the next 20 years in the United States, of the growth in the U.S. workforce, 52% of the growth in the U.S. workforce is going to be Hispanics. And the workforce is America's economic engine. And so there are some significant implications of this, because 52% of our growth in our workforce is Hispanic. Now we look at the worker earnings by race, ethnicity, and educational attainment. And you look at the Hispanic median and average earnings, and they are less than the high school, just slightly higher than taking all categories into account that exist in the high school. And of course, as you get more education, then your earnings potential increases significantly. Now, earnings goes, it's translated into per capita income, which is what's needed to support your population. And so I set Oregon's per capita income at 100, and then I compared the per capita income for the different racial and ethnic categories. And you can see that the Hispanic per capita income is 45% of the white per capita income. And this has significant implications on our economy and a lot of other factors. One, of course, the interesting things is that look at the ratio of working age persons to persons age 65 and over. In 1940, there were 8.6 working persons for everyone age 65 and over. In the year 2000, it's down to 4.7. In the year 2030, it's going to be down to 2.8. And so this is the working people who's going to be supporting the our tax base, or the retirement system, everything else, and what's going to be the composition of that workforce. There's 2.8 persons for everyone age 65 and over. There's an interesting comment when I showed the slide at Mount Hood Community College. Someone in the audience says, "My God, I always knew it was the right thing to do to make sure that we were educating all of our population, including our minorities, but now I realize my retirement is going to be dependent on it." I thought that was a very telling comment. I thought it would be really interesting to look at what this has an impact on our federal and state revenues, because we're basically based on income taxes. And so what I did, I thought it would be interesting in Oregon to take a median white household, I actually ran a tax return, federal and state income tax returns for that median household income. I also did it for a median Hispanic household income to see what the tax ramifications were. And when I ran that, and I of course had to adjust because the median white household at 2.4 persons per household and the Hispanic was 4.2. And so I did one on either side, and I extrapolated in between. When I ran it, there was a 100% reduction in federal tax revenues, the median Hispanic household actually qualified for a $90 rebate from the federal tax revenues. When you look at Oregon's revenue implications, there was a 66% reduction in Oregon tax revenues as you make this transition from a white household to a Hispanic household, unless you change the earnings potential that exists. And that's the message I think that this thing, that this slide needs to say. If we don't change that earnings potential, we don't reach out, make sure that all of our population is being adequately educated and receiving that education, we are going to be in a world of hurt. I thought that this was an extremely telling slide here that people better be aware of, because it's the future unless we make some changes. Next thing was looking at household composition. And pop represents what's sort of been thought as the traditional American household, two-parent with children under 18. In 1960, that represented 43% of Oregon's households. In 2000, that was down to 22% of Oregon's households was that traditional married couple with children under 18. The next category is the single parent with children under 18. That's gone from 3.6% to 8.6%. The only household category that has remained basically the same is the families with no children under 18, and that has been approximately 35-36% of our total household composition over the last number of years. A significant growth has been in the multi-person non-family households. It's went from 1.5% to 8.1% over this number of decades. And of course, the single-person household has gone from 16% to 26%. And I thought, well, maybe that's because of the fact that we have an aging population. And yet, when I looked in 1980, of that single-person households, only 8.9% of them were 65 and older, and that had only grown to 9.1% in the year 2000. So those single-person households are not just the older population. So I did some analysis, and I found out that, for one thing, in the last 20 years, the average first-time age of marriage for males and females has increased by over 2 years. And so people are waiting longer to get married, and maybe they maintain a single-person household longer. That could be one explanation. I haven't had a chance to do an analysis to determine if that is, in fact, the case. If we look at what are the types of households that are being formed over the last four decades, and the percent of these five different household categories, again, for the last three decades, on the far right in the yellow here, that's this married couple of children under 18. In fact, in the 80s, Oregon actually lost those households. More of those households moved out than were formed in Oregon. And yet, for the last three decades, that has been the smallest number of households being formed, every other household category. And of course, it's either the single parent with children under 18 or that married couple with children under 18, which is the what the educational system should be addressing. So what are some conclusions that we can draw from this? One, that the U.S. and Oregon is rapidly changing from a nation that's been primarily white, non-Hispanic, to a racially and ethnically diverse population. That Hispanic, Latino, and Asian populations are the fastest growing cohorts, white only the slowest. That Hispanic, Latino population increases now for the greatest percent of U.S. population growth. And that all of our planning and policy decisions in education, housing, social services should reflect these patterns of growth, because if we don't, we're going to be missing the boat in a lot of different areas. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Bielan? Well, see, now you know what a handful of novices you have here.
Well, hopefully you will see why I think that this is some needed information that needs to be taken into account by anyone in policy-making decisions, whether it's related to education or many other aspects of government, that it's not only our educational systems that's going to be impacted, it's all of our other educational systems that I was asked to present to DHS when they were going through their potential reorganization effort to so that they could get a handle on their needs to address the changing population that they will be facing. And I think certainly from our future revenue system, we better be aware of these factors and do everything that we can to make sure. I know that, for example, in Woodburn, some of the students did a hunger fast in support of the previous Senator Courtney's and the last biennium to allow people who are not immigrants who qualify for in-state tuition, so that because this has become a compelling need in talking with the people in the educational system, we need to have teachers who can deal with these cultural and issues associated with the changing mix of the student population. And so we need to have teacher training for people who are of a similar cultural background, who can relate and deal with all of these issues. And I think that's very important for the educational system and the higher educational system to make sure that we are doing everything possible to encourage minority teacher development or non-minority cultural training to deal with the very significant issues. We can't afford to have a 60% dropout rate for a significant portion of our population. That's going to be a key component of our workforce and every other aspect of educational and service delivery.
Go ahead. Representative Roblin, then Representative Farr, and then I have a question.
Thank you. A couple of questions. The first one, what has been the actual growth in Oregon percentage-wise?
Which growth?
The growth of Oregon, actual growth in population.
Oregon grew by, in the last decade, by I think it was like 18 or 20%, something like that. It's been running about just under 1.9% per year during the 90s, the total population.
So the next part of that question has to do then, many of your slides were about the makeup of that growth.
Right.
And so in your actual report, do you have the actual number, I mean the full report that's on the web, the actual numbers?
Yeah.
Because
yes.
Percentages can be very deceiving when the numbers are very small of growth, 1.1% growth, a portion of that being any particular group. So I think until you really look at the fact that it takes 40 or 50 years for that to change the big population, it is because that growth is so small. And the percentage growth may look pretty large, but they may not indicate large numbers, I think.
But I think that it is changing very rapidly. And you take California.
Yes.
I mean, California went from 20% to over 50% in that 30-year time frame, and that's
right.
A huge state.
Absolutely.
And and we look at Marion County's. I mean, 80% of Marion County's population growth was it. So, and that's on a small base. As that base increases, it's, you know, geometric from that standpoint because of these other factors and variables.
Yes. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Roland, because I did have that question as well in regard to comparing what the numbers represent, the percentage increases were represented with the numbers that sustained them. So,
yeah,
Representative Farr.
Well, that was one of my questions, but then I just thought of another one. You were referring to a bill from the last session, I think it was Senate Bill 10, where it allowed the children of a non-resident alien, illegal, possibly, who had lived in the United States for at least 3 years and had graduated from an Oregon high school,
absolutely.
And it would allow them to go to college and pay in-state tuition versus out-of-state tuition,
right.
Which basically allowed them an education because, of course, they couldn't afford out-of-state tuition. But it was, but just point of clarification, it was not free tuition.
No. Right.
Would those students, would they qualify for today's Oregon opportunity grant under the current guidelines?
I will be first to admit I'm not an expert or knowledgeable on that aspect of it, but I'm just more or less bringing it up as an example of what the Woodburn student population sees as a real need that can help address this issue.
Well, and then follow-up, Madam Chair? And then my follow-up would be that in Woodburn, because of the very high, disproportionately high number of Latino students, that they would be the benefits of that type of program.
Yes. Right, right.
You use Woodburn in a few of your examples. Now, I believe I is correct that Woodburn has a significant Russian population.
Yes.
As well. Have you done any numbers to reflect that dynamic?
Actually, they are included in my full presentation, too. I mean, when you look at, in fact, the white non-Russian population is only about 18% of Woodburn student population. So while Hispanics are now up to about 72%, almost 10% of it was a Russian population as well. So I think in the last 2004, there were like 830 white students, about 500 Russian students, and then like 3,400 Hispanic students in the school system.
Interesting. So that is in your full presentation that we can go online and review. Thank you. Representative Lin?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. That the alarming issue in the future is that it will be a less revenue for the state, as you shown it. It's decreased fundings more than 50%. Am I correct? I think almost 60%. At the same time,
when you replace a white,
yes,
household with a Hispanic,
exactly,
household under the same situations today. Right?
Exactly. And at the same time, they demand more funding for education. I think that will be the major challenge in the future. Less revenue, but the more funding for education. And I'm not sure who can answer that questions in the future, that the now and the future. We need to have a real policy problem in the future. You know, we need to set some kind of a policy, make sure in the future there is adequate funding for education.
Representative Lim, I agree with you. We need to address not only our immediate concerns, but our long-range plans. And so
yes,
I hope
exactly.
That's what we're working toward as well. Thank you very much. Did you have any questions, Representative Collins?
No, thank you.
Representative Shields?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Yellen.
Thanks.
Appreciate your information very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to come before you.
Okay, we're going to take just a technological timeout, and then we will transition to some information from the Council on Developmental Disabilities, and Catherine White will be first to present.
Resources followed based on formulas.
That's 2:10.
I can tell you why.
Chair Flores and members of the committee, my name is Sharon Lewis, for the record, and we are actually here to speak about early intervention, early childhood special education services, despite the information in the agenda. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. This is a program that's very near and dear to my heart. I'm here in multiple roles. I'm the chair of the Family Action Coalition team, which is a nonprofit coalition of cross-disability organizations focused on family disability issues and providing education and information. Our members represent thousands of families of children with disabilities across the state. Some of you from the last session may recognize me also as one of the primary organizers of the Teddy Bear Picnic Rally when we all came down and provided you with a couple thousand teddy bears with all our kids' stories attached. With me today are several other parents, as well as some members of the State Interagency Coordinating Council and representation from the Oregon Department of Education Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. Between all of us, hopefully we'll give you a better understanding of early intervention, early childhood special education services. Most importantly, I'm here as a parent. My daughter Zoe is an alumni of the Portland Early Intervention Childhood, Early Intervention Early Childhood Special Education Services. I'm going to jump to saying EIECSE here for purposes of my presentation.
First, I would say thank you very much for telling us what it was versus what I have to sockifying on that.
It's a mouthful. Zoe was born with a rare genetic condition which resulted in multiple hospitalizations, a gamut of therapy needs, and neurosurgery as an infant and throughout her early childhood. She struggled to learn to walk, to eat, to learn many things that come very easily for other kids. We spent hours and hours learning how to do things as simple as use a fork. At the same time, she's an incredibly happy, outgoing, playful child who is currently 8 years old. She had celebrated her 8th birthday on Monday. She's learning to ride a bike, play the drums, and other typical activities for an 8-year-old. She, as a second grader, is fully included currently in the Portland Public Schools with some supports to her in a general education setting, and I attribute her success tremendously to early intervention, early childhood special education. Recently on a reading assessment, she tested out at reading as a mid-first grade level, and I think that a lot of that has to do with the work that we did with her as a preschooler. Early intervention, early childhood special ed is one of the few services that really focuses on the family and brings the pieces together. The assistance and services that we receive would not have been available.
Hi, Carly.
Would not have been available to us otherwise. Zoe and thousands of babies, infants, and young children have benefited from the long tradition of early intervention services in Oregon. Early on, our state recognized the importance of supporting the needs of these children and their families. The program was created in state statute in 1983, long before many other states had programs. We aligned with the federal laws in 1992 and have since been in compliance with the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Act. Our state statute also recognizes the importance of the role of family participation and interagency collaboration in the mandated support for the State Interagency Coordinating Council, the SICC, of which you'll hear from a couple of members here today. The SICC consists of parents, early childhood professionals from the medical, educational, child care, and a variety of early childhood agencies on the state level. They serve as the advisory to the governor, the superintendent of public instruction, and other policymakers. On the local level, we have local interagency coordinating councils, LICCs, that serve in the same capacity on a county-by-county basis. So I'm going to turn the floor over to some of the other parents here today, and I thank you very much for your time in hearing about this important program. Do you want to speak her? Is she okay?
I hope. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Representatives. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Jamie Birch, and I live in Portland, and this is my daughter, Jamie, and she's 18 months old, and she currently receives early intervention services in Multnomah County. That's a microphone. I want to just tell a little bit about our experience with early intervention and how much she has benefited from it. She is 18 months again, and she's been receiving early intervention since she was about a month old, 2 months old in the classroom. And I kind of skipped around, but just to give you a little bit more information about myself, I'm also a board member of the Northwest Down Syndrome Association, which is the group responsible for providing the calendars, the Down Syndrome Now calendars that the legislators got earlier this week. And I want the best for my children and their future, and I know the early intervention program does as well, and that's what they've shown me, and they've proven that through all the times that we have spent with them, and they've consulted to us. And briefly, we started with early intervention when she was 2 weeks old. They came to our house and kind of told us about the services that they would be providing and she would be receiving. And when Carly was a month old, we had our first early intervention meeting to discuss her assessment plan, which is where we set up her IFSP, the Individualized Family Service Plan, and that's just a plan that describes her abilities, goals, and needs, and kind of what we would be doing for about the next 6 months. A few days after that meeting, I received a packet in the mail from an education specialist with EI, and I remember a message that she wrote to me, which was, we all learn best when we are enjoying ourselves. And so I looked through those papers, and it reminded me of the things that I instinctually did with my older daughter, but had kind of forgotten to do with Carly because I was so wrapped up in everything else. That's just a little bit about our experience. The early intervention has definitely been good for us and valuable, and we take advantage of all of their services because it is so beneficial to her. Thank you.
Representatives. My name is Tracy Bowler, and I'm from Silverton area. This is my son, Brogan. He is an almost three-year-old who had a very difficult birth and had some traumatic head injuries from a long phase of pushing. But he ended up with early intervention services right from the beginning as well, about a month old. Some fine motor and growth motor skills, they had thought that he might not even be able to walk. And he did everything on time with early intervention, meeting every week and doing PT and OT and speech and various many other scheduling activities. And they also came up to our house, which was incredible because we live up in the hills. We're a good 55 minutes from Salem. And then about 18 months old, he had a sedation with a hearing test, and we found out that he had moderate to severe hearing loss, which was quite a surprise to us. And early intervention was right there with us, fitting him with his hearing aids at 18 months old. And they had a hearing specialist who comes out to our house every week who taught us how to check the hearing aids to make sure they're working, how to maintain them, how to put them on him, how to keep them on him, which I thought would be challenging, but once we put them on him, he actually never takes them off. He wears them all waking hours, and he definitely knows what they're for. They also have a focus group that he has been a part of that meets twice a month in Salem at Salem Heights Preschool, where he will go with deaf and hard of hearing children. And this is with five other 18 to 2.5-year-olds who are all deaf or hard of hearing, and it's great for him for socialization and activities. And when he does hit preschool in March, they will also they will transfer him for me from Silverton to Salem, which is great because we also have a 1-year-old. During all of this time, we had another newborn, and one of the other great things that they did for us, since commuting was such a long ordeal, and I also work part-time as a nurse, is they had it's kind of like a high-tech van that the audiologist would come out for, and he'd actually come to Silverton, and Brogan would get fitted for his ear molds. He needs them every 3 months, new ones, and they would do that right on site, and then they would deliver that up to our house, and these were just incredible things. The other thing that I just want to really thank early intervention for is not only do they focus on your child, but they deal with the parents, and if the parents aren't there with understanding and support and education, I don't think that we're able to let our children thrive as well as we do. And they were right there for us as well as our child, and I just can't imagine what we would do without them. They've been a huge help.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, good job. Let's clean up. Let's clean up. Thank you.
Should I just go?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, My name is Judy Newman, and I'm on the State Interagency Coordinating Council, and I was asked to talk to you, give you a basic overview of early intervention, early childhood special ed, and the handout you're getting, I'm going to pretty much go through it and try to give you just an idea of what we're about. And I'll probably use EIECSE to be shorter, too, but just think of, you know, Old McDonald's or something that fits with our age group, EI.
We can get that.
Good. It works. Early intervention and early childhood special education is really special education for kids birth to five. It is defined in federal law, IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and also in Oregon law. And it's an entitlement program for eligible children. We've had early intervention, early childhood special ed in Oregon. It's been mandated since 1992 and even have a longer history of serving young kids, boy, starting back in the 70s in Oregon. As of December 2004, we've been serving, now this is an unofficial number, but we wanted to give you just a general idea of about 7,800 children. Obviously, you'll get the official counts from the Oregon Department of Ed, but it's just a general idea of how many kids this program touches in Oregon. Who's eligible for services? Well, I have a list for you of examples of the kinds of disabilities that make kids eligible, but you just got to see. I have genetic disorders such as Down syndrome, but I could just say children like Carly. Autism, deafness or hearing impairment, blindness, cerebral palsy, emotional disturbance, communication disorder, and just developmental delay. At this age, sometimes you don't know what it is, but you know the children just are delayed in their development. They need help. Kinds of services that are provided. This is, again, a list, and I think you've heard that it's individualized. There's not a child in the program that gets all of these at once, but you have these available because every child with special needs has different needs, and we match the services to fit those needs. So parent education and support and consultation are critical. You can see speech and language therapy, occupational physical therapy, specialized preschool instruction, autism services, specialized equipment and materials, and also linkages to other services and supports that families may need. The early intervention, early childhood people really will make sure that families get linked up to medical services or other social services. Services are individually determined. You heard the parents talk about an IFSP. Probably many of you know what an IEP is, Individualized Education Plan. Well, this is the baby's version, and the F means family, and you, again, heard the only difference between an IEP and an IFSP is that we include family outcomes. We recognize kids are home with their parents, and we really need to look at the child in the context of the family. And then you can see the list of where services are provided. We try to start where kids typically are. Where are young kids, their peers in the community, and how can we make those environments work for them, whether it be their home, the child care site they go to, preschools. I think you've heard a lot about Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Head Start. We have kids in those programs as well. Specialized preschools and other community programs. Crisis relief nurseries are in some communities, and that's also a really good partner where we can meet the kids' special needs right there. How are these services funded? We have federal funds from IDEA. We have state general funds. That's the biggest portion of our funding, and that's in the grant and aid budget. And we the programs do bill Medicaid on the education side fee for service, and we do recoup some money, a small amount, between 1% and 2%. Who refers children to early intervention, early childhood special ed? Basically, anyone in the community who feels there's a problem can let families know or the physicians know that this service exists. I made a list of we do collect information on referrals, and these are the places where we get the vast majority of referrals. Parents themselves obviously recognize when their kids have problems. Child care providers, Oregon pre-kindergarten, physicians, etc. The other point I just really want to make is that private therapies and services that treat young children with special needs really are non-existent in most communities in Oregon. There are a few communities that have a few services, but if you're a parent and you can afford it or you'd like to go and purchase these services, you're not going to be able to find them out there to meet the needs of their kids. These are really critical.
And cuts in other services in our community really have an impact on EIECSC because families look to us if some of their other services are being cut. Outcomes. Maybe you're interested in how we're doing. We do have some outcomes that we're happy to report. 100% of the eligible children have their vision, hearing, and health screened. This is a critical time of development, as you all know, for kids' brains. And if you don't find these problems, hearing problems, vision problems, at this young age and treat them, you've really lost out. 100% of eligible children have individualized goals written to address their areas of needs. So intervention is very focused, and those goals have criteria and how you're going to evaluate them, so you're ensuring that kids are making progress all along to achieve those goals. 95% of the children made measurable developmental gains in their areas of development. And the 5% kids, you might say, why aren't they? Well, those are kids that usually that are having some kind of medical crisis or have some kind of degenerative problem. So really the vast majority of kids we can really demonstrate with annual assessments that are making progress. And the majority of parents report, 90% of the parents report that they learn skills and knowledge to parent a child with special needs. And you hear this over and over when you hear parents speak. I don't really know what to do. You know, I've raised other kids that are typically developing, but what do I do with this child with special needs? The graphs I'm not going to spend time on, but you could take a look. When I talk about making progress, all children in the program get an annual curriculum-based assessment, and so you could, and in the areas of delay. So if you just look at CARA at the top, the first two bars would show pre and post in 1 year growth in cognitive development, problem-solving skills. And I list what those are down there so you really know what those are. The next would be communication. The next two would be social. And the last would be self-care kinds of things. And when you have a moment, you can see what that is referring to. Ready for school. We have two regions in Oregon that have been collecting data on what happens to kids when they go to kindergarten for the last 5 or 6 years. And what we have seen is that 18 to 21% of the children that leave early childhood special ed services go to kindergarten don't need anything when they enter school. They're no longer eligible. They don't need any more services. 47 to 58% of the kids that do enter school needing some services actually get placed into their neighborhood kindergarten. They can go right into their kindergarten with their neighbors and get some special education services there, like speech and language therapy or some resource room help. 100% of the children who do transition to school, no matter what the services they need, enter school the very first day ready to learn. I can't emphasize this enough. These children may have special needs, but they show up day one, entering kindergarten, in some ways more ready than other kids because they have an eligibility, they have goals established, they have information about what teaching strategies work. And the last bullet really points out that this information is provided to kindergarten teachers by the EIECSC staff, and it decreases the need for valuable K-12 staff time and resources to reevaluate and figure that out all over. The last thing is collaborations. I think that Sharon spoke about those. You can see the list of agencies that we've had a long time to collaborate with. And I'm just going to leave you with an example because, again, I know you've heard a lot about Oregon pre-kindergarten and Head Start. And let me just give you an example of how we work together. The Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Ed programs provide the specialized services and supports to children in those classrooms. The same way, like if you went into a K-12 program, special education provides specialized services to kids in a regular school setting. The specialized services and supports enable the child with special needs to function in and benefit from a preschool setting. Those preschools are set up for typically developing kids, and you need to make some adaptations, some changes to make that work. So, for example, a speech therapist from the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Ed program will go into the classroom, provide speech therapy to that child, write the goals, track the child's progress, and also teach those Head Start teachers how to reinforce that language all day, every day with the child. The same thing might happen with adapting curriculum in the other bullets. So we work together as partners so that the special needs are met and the kids' preschool needs are met through Head Start. Lastly, you heard about the SICC. I'm here representing them today, and we really want to thank you for your support. The Oregon legislature has been very supportive of early intervention, early childhood special ed. You can see these are critical services, and they're effective. Thank you. Phew, 101.
You did well.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Bob Nickel. I'm a professor of pediatrics, a developmental pediatrician at OHSU, and I represent the Child Development Rehabilitation Center on the SICC. And I'm here to talk about the relationship between early intervention and health professionals. And what I'm going to do is kind of describe two sets of parents to you from my clinical practice. And I think these parents are representative of many other health professionals in this state. And both sets of parents, if you will, are young. They could be your sons or daughters or mine, or maybe even for some of us, our grandsons or daughters. And they're worried. Their kids, their infants are 8 or 10 months of age, and they're not keeping up with their developmental milestones. They're also hopeful that this doesn't mean anything, that their kid is going to catch up. The first set of parents is a child I see in my practice, and I diagnose a definite genetic or birth defect syndrome. The second set of parents, I'll look at the child. This child's delayed for the child's age, but I'm not sure why. The parents ask, does that mean my daughter or my son's going to catch up? And I have to say, I don't know. It's critically important for those parents, and you can imagine their feelings or their emotions as they walk out my door or the door of any other health professionals in that circumstance. It's critically important for those parents to have support. And that is the gist and the bedrock of the relationship between health professionals and early intervention. Early intervention provides parents that support. They help the first set of parents understand the particular disability or problem that child has. They help the second set of parents begin to work positively to build on their child's skills to actually find out if that child is going to catch up. The other way early intervention can help health professionals, and it happens has happened over and over again in my practice over the last 25 years, is that they carefully monitor children in their programs. They oftentimes are the first to identify some health and some serious health problems, such as seizures, such as children with hydrocephalus who have shunts. When shunts start to malfunction, they oftentimes are manifested as change in behavior or developmental skills. So the partnership between health and early intervention is longstanding and a critically important one, both for the children, families, the providers, as well as the health professionals in this state. So I'm here to recommend that you do your best to maintain this partnership by funding the early intervention, early childhood special education programs.
Thank you, Dr. Catherine, are you up next? No? You're traffic director.
Correct.
Okay.
My name is Joe. My name is Investor. My name is Sam Gassel. I'm 20 years old. I'm in my first grade at Gaffer School in Colias. I have 3 nieces. So I have dinner called FC Sam. When I was a baby, it was hard to do the thing, small things. So my mom and my dad helped me and told me I was broken. The things most babies do. My mom and my dad got me and told me I was broken to need to know how to tap it to help me. So I started thinking of some nice people helped me. They helped me to help me know this world, to help me to know to be myself, to help me to know to set up and grow, to help me to know to talk, to help me know to walk. To help me not to talk, to help me not to help myself. To help my mom, and dad, not how to take care of me. To help my family to see how it takes longer than other kids. I can learn anything. The same thing to nothing till I was 5 and I went to kindergarten at my ECT nursing teachers. They saw I was ready to start school. To have my mom be nice enough to let me go. To have my car gone, she took it away from me. Now in fourth grade, I left school 2 years old. That's this. The most of the time I love to eat, and right next to we cook the underpants and now the wings. When I go up on to walk at Disney and the Pirate Ride, I put up movie. Called Sam Castle the movie. I want to be a star and ask a pen to beat the American Hair Duff. Some people told my mom and dad I want no one on how to walk or talk or read. These people want. And this is nothing that no kids can order. I'm not that give a set makes sense and have me so it'll be under things I can do. Now I can do it in the first time. Thank you for asking.
Sam, you did a very nice job. Thank you very much. Representative Dolan would like to ask you a question. Is that okay?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Do you really like Captain Underpants?
Yeah.
Do all third, fourth, and fifth graders like Captain Underpants?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Sam, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you really like Hillary Duff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Gelser, and I am the proud mother of Sam Gelser, who is 10, and my husband Peter and two of my daughters are here today. When Sam was born 10 years ago, it seemed like everything was aligned perfectly for him. I had a strong marriage, so he had parents that were very committed to each other. We had a foundation and a strong faith life. We had parents that supported us very strongly. We had good health insurance that ensured that we could have good quality medical care. I had a background in education, and we were fortunate enough to have plenty of financial resources at our disposal to meet the needs of our children. What we didn't expect was to have a child with a disability who I knew nothing about. And while my parents were there to help me and my husband's parents, they had never had a child like Sam either. And while we were really good at research and reading, there were no books about kids like Sam. And while we were good at seeking out community resources, there weren't typical generic resources in the community that could support Sam. And despite our great insurance, we couldn't find any services that our insurance would cover because, like most good insurance plans, all services to children with developmental delays, physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, are not covered because of the clause that excludes people with disabilities from receiving these services. Early intervention was the only place that we could receive these services. And even if we had had the money, and we were very fortunate financially, but even if we had had the money to buy the services, they would not have been available anyplace. So these are services that are unduplicated in the public sector or in the private sector, and they are absolutely essential. We were very committed to helping Sam, and Sam was right. When we were little, there were many people that told us that he would never succeed at much of anything. There was, in fact, a day when we were told that Sam wouldn't live to be two, and he's clearly proven all of those things to be wrong. And I fully credit early intervention and Sam's hard work with helping us to do that. One other perspective that I have on early intervention and early childhood special education is that for the past 4 years, I've served as a member of the Corvallis School Board. And like most school board members and school administrators across the state, I'm always very interested in ensuring that our K-12 resources can be put to their best use. What I see in our school district with class sizes in kindergarten that can reach 30 kids are that those kindergarten teachers would not be equipped to meet the needs of children like Sam if they came without those basic interventions early on to bring them to school ready to learn, to be able to sit in a seat both physically and behaviorally, to be able to attend to activities, and to have learned those basic skills. The early intervention program is able to provide those teachers with good evaluation background, with good good background about how to adapt their classrooms and how to meet the kids' needs. And that's not just good for Sam. That's good for the other 29 kindergartners in the classroom, because that means that that's time and energy that that teacher can put towards doing what her job is, which is to teach all kids, Sam and his classmates. So thank you very much for your ongoing support of early intervention, early childhood special education. I know we have a lot of problems in our state, but this is one of those programs that's working really well, and this is one of these things that Oregon just does right. And Sam is a great example of one of those success stories. So thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you, Sam.
Madam Chair.
Representative Farr.
I have
Sarah?
A question for Sam and his mother.
Oh. Oh.
What channel would I find Captain Underpants on?
Do you want to answer that question? Is he on TV?
A book.
Oh, it's a book. So I could check out a book from maybe my local public library?
Okay.
Well, could you recommend a specific volume? Is there a certain Captain Underpants story that I should look for?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there just one?
There's a good number. One of Sam's favorite is The Adventures of the Wicked Wedgie Woman. So, Captain... It's a very third, fourth grade boy geared.
It's filled with wedgies.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that vivid description, Representative Dahlem.
And I actually have to correct Sarah on that. It's not necessarily gender-based, because as a parent of a second-grade daughter who also enjoys Captain Underpants, we're very, very familiar with these characters. That basically concludes our presentation today, and all of us are here available to answer questions. And I don't know if... Department of Ed is here and is happy to also participate in the questions.
Wedgie Woman?
Wicked Wedgie Woman.
Wicked Wedgie Woman.
Okay. Go read in the fifth grade. I can't get away from it.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Latini, and I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships, of which the Early Intervention and the whole Early Childhood Unit is a part of. I prepared no testimony today because I thought that the best thing you could hear was from the actual service providers and the people who receive the services. I think what you probably saw best is that there is a requirement to serve these kids under federal law and state law. However, we have a commitment to these students, and you can see what happens when the service providers really have a commitment, not just that they're required to do this, and the belief that we have in that these children can grow and benefit from these services. So thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have them for me.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. Do we know what percentage of parents don't take advantage? Because I know these are not required programs. And so do we know the percentage of parents out there who are not taking advantage?
I could get that information. We're starting to collect information on, we are collecting information on the referrals and the parents that don't go through and why not at this point, so we know what to focus our efforts on. We can get that information for you.
Thank you, Representative Dahlem.
Could you tell me how these services are provided in Mitchell, Long Creek, and the rural schools, which are numerous in my district?
Chair Flores, Representative Dahlem, they're contracted through regional ESD programs, and so they would hire people that either travel to those areas or already are in those areas as subcontractors providing the services to the students and their families.
And, of course, we know that ESD is a fine, but that stands for Educational Service
I'm
District.
I'm sorry. I'll for you.
Thank you. I owe you for that.
Wouldn't have got the fine if I hadn't asked the question.
Did you know Representative Dahlem? I used to live in Long Creek.
Did you vote for me?
It was before streets were paved. It was long, long ago. Any further questions for Ms. Latini? Thank you very much, and thank you.
Representative Flores?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, no, it's all right. I have a question I'm not sure that that anyone here can answer. Maybe Judy would be a good person to ask this question of. But regarding health care benefits, that was a piece that I didn't understand. So health insurance, the majority of health insurance coverage does not include services for children with developmental disabilities.
can take that one.
Is it just developmental disabilities?
Frequently, private health care, Chair Flores and Representative Farr, frequently private health plans do not cover therapies and treatments that are related specifically to a developmental disability, especially after the age of 7. Speaking from personal experience, I can tell you that that's my situation and that's many, many, many families' situations. We do have, through the Oregon Health Plan, families are able to access some therapeutic benefit, saw a reduction in those benefits last year. But from a family perspective, many, many families are not able to access those services through their private plans due to specific exclusions.
Would those exclusions apply to like hearing aids, or would those be included under most health plans?
I can speak to this a little bit from my experience. On the medical side, there's a division between what are medically based therapy services and what most health insurance plans will cover medically based. So PTOT speech in a medical setting, but will not cover them in a non-medical setting. So we're talking about basically an educational-based program here. Mm-hmm. In terms of hearing aids, yes, generally those kinds of services would be covered under a health plan. That's a kind of a real broad, simple outline of how it works. And there are issues, as I'm sure you're all aware, in terms of the budget issues with the Oregon Health Plan and the amount of therapy services or the amount of benefits that are even available in medical settings.
The other thing related to health insurance that we're seeing happen more and more, in our community we have a clinic called the Eugene Hearing and Speech Center that does some private kinds of services. And parents used to be able to go there and have their child's speech and language assessed, for example. Now when they submit that to the insurance, they say, no, they should go to early intervention, early childhood special ed. They will reject those claims. And the other thing I'd add is families whose health care would not cover hearing aids, for example, early intervention, early childhood special ed will pick those up too.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When a student like your child all of a sudden needs care at a hospital facility, mm-hmm. and it may be a long ways away from where the care is, the education is, do the services follow? I mean, do they provide services at those other areas if they're there for a long period of time?
Yes.
Okay.
That appears to be it. Thank you very much, all. Thank you, families. Thank you, children, many of whom have left. You've blessed our day. Thank you.
Thank you.
A committee, before we adjourn, I would like to have brought to your attention, you should have received or should be receiving a memo from Committee Administrator Jim Keller regarding our February 24th meeting, which is the joint meeting with the Audits Committee, the House Education Committee at Wilson High School. That would be on Thursday. That is a regular Education Committee meeting. It will replace our meeting on Friday. So it is basically then a required attendance, please. And if you need transportation arrangements, please check in with Mr. Keller. The information you have, I guess you do have it in front of you. Any questions, please check with Mr. Keller or with me.
What time are we leaving here?
Mr. Keller?
I have a 1 o'clock. Yeah. The college was that environment for me.
Kelly and I will actually be leaving Salem about noon. So if you're needing transportation...
I don't need that. I can drive.
Okay. So the meeting will be starting at 3.
3?
At Wilson High School.
Wilson High School.
Right.
How long will it take?
About an hour.
Yeah.
About an hour?
Close to an hour.
Okay, so if I maybe excuse me a little early, I might be able to get there.
Yes.
Thank you. And I do realize that does require perhaps some juggling of schedules, meetings, and what have you. So I appreciate that. And if you need a note from Mother, we'll arrange that.
Linda, how is parking at Wilson? Will school be getting out about the time that we get there, and will there be parking available?
Well, I'm suspecting that it will be a state of transition, but there should probably be parking. We can get the details to you.
Vice Principal, I mean, we would be at that moment of transition.
Okay, so is there alternate parking if the parking lot at Wilson is full? Or
I've never been there, so I couldn't answer that right off the top of my head.
That might be good information to have ahead of time so that we kind of have an idea.
We're going to get there plenty early, so we'll be able to look the situation over.
Okay.
And then we can just call back to you.
Yeah,
that'll be great.
You can call me on my
cell. What are the major topics?
That's what I was thinking.
We will be...
valet parking?
Valet parking.
We will be covering, in this joint committee, we will be covering the responses that the audit committee had requested from the Department of Education in regard to assessments and some of the information that had been presented to us as far as the development of the assessment protocols, and then are with a overlay into our education committee then in regard to assessments / the certificate of initial mastery, advanced mastery.
Okay.
So we'll be taking public testimony on that and have some Department of Education testimony on that function.
Are you looking?
Sorry.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say I appreciate your work to find a time and a date that really works for most of us. This is really a positive that's come out of this. So I appreciate your work in getting this to work out.
Thank you. And thank you for your facilitating that as well.
To our Administrator, Jim, are you going to have a bus leaving here at a particular time?
So far, I think there's only one representative that I need to talk to about transportation. Everyone else seemed to want to take themselves.
I'll be one of those taking myself. I need to speak with the chairman of economic development and see if I should ride his bus or not.
Do you want to take that off the record here?
I will carry you on my back.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Our committee is adjourned.